Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1283.PR3122, certificate number 13953. Teddy Girls.
Ken, I know you love rock and roll.
Oh, boy. Boy, do I love rock and roll. I just go home and I turn on some Carl Perkins or some Duane Eddy.
It feels like it's, of the two of
funny,
us.
It's funny to say and roll, right? Doesn't it sound funny now?
Rock and roll.
Yeah, rock and roll, right?
Yeah.
Rock and roll you play on a jukebox.
You like rock and roll more than I do.
Yes. Although, as a Gen Xer, I would probably say rock, you know?
Right.
Like, as a musician, I think you have license to say things like, yeah, man, it's good old rock and roll. But if I say I like rock and roll, what are you picturing?
I guess you're right. It is pretty Carl Perkins-y. I like rock and roll.
We have both kinds of music.
Yeah.
Rock and roll. Well, they got rid of the roll. You know, they, as rock got wider and louder and, you know, more about the thum, 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 thum beat, there's less roll.
Yeah.
R&B got roll.
Considerably less swing, I guess, isn't there?
Rock kept rock.
But I think, I mean, I'm not sure whether this is I think this might be one of these many generational differences between you and me that I like to point out. That oldies radio when I was a kid was still pre-rock.
You had Sinatra.
And then
we had Love and Spoonful and
right.
Tommy James and the Shondells on oldies radio.
Watching oldies radio make the transition, I remember because my dad listened to oldies radio. And
was he crabby about that? He was like, they're not playing Bing Crosby anymore.
Well, he didn't understand it. How the hell is this oldies? This is from 1958.
Well, except now we have that. Oldies station, they're playing Where the Streets Have No Name.
I know.
Oldies, but that's a mere 40 years old.
But it did feel like and now I think when you listen back to jazz of the late 40s and particularly 50s, the stark contrast between that and early rock that we used to feel very strongly, like, well, that's not rock, but that is rock. Now, I don't think a 20-year-old now would listen to music on either side of that line and see it.
It doesn't sound like a revolution.
It doesn't really. The cool combo jazz of 1948 and the little and the rockabilly combos of 1956, it feels like on a pretty steady continuum.
This was me as a kid trying to figure out Dylan going electric.
Why
would anybody be mad about that? So, Bob Dylan is singing a folk song that sounds like, but now he's got, and there's a bass.
Clang.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
That's your revolution?
So strange.
Judas.
How many of those big, and I think about this all the time listening to, what you're describing as oldies or classic rock radio, where in a single hour, the playlist will throw together 9 songs that we would have thought of as such completely disparate genres that they never would appear. Like even at home, no one person would own those records.
Yeah.
You would have to be.
Because it's a social statement if you own that kind or this kind.
Yeah. You'd have to be a schizophrenic to be able to listen to both Blondie and Judas Priest in the same half an hour. And, you know, the radio now is just like, la-di-da-di-da, everything from then is the same.
They, you know, generations are increasingly less concerned with era, it seems like. A lot of, I mean, my kids had access to generations of past music, not just through their parents, but through, I mean, now it's TikTok, you know? Like TikTok will just, or the algorithm will, suddenly kids will be fascinated by like some random television song or something. Like by the band Television, not from from their televisions. Yeah, like the theme to Simon
your way
and Simon.
In the world today takes everything you got.
Kids love the theme to Magnum PI. They're like, I have a Mike Post. I have a poster of Mike Post in my bedroom, and I love all his work. No, they're just they're pretty ecumenical. Is that the term?
Yeah, I think
when it
so.
Comes to eras or you know. It's just, whereas, yeah, like when I was a kid, I remember like, what, you're listening to something from 3 years ago? Whoa.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Weirdo. Like, we all have the new Lionel Richie record. What are you listening to?
I think about this sometimes when I just, you know, I'll just wake up in the night almost and be like, do you remember how mad everyone was about In Through the Outdoor? Like, there's just, you know, some record would come out and it would just be like, wow. What a betrayal, or you know, like Rock is Dead and all these things. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like,
I've read a couple of books.
The Outdoors is a great record.
I've read a couple of books lately about punk purity.
Yeah.
And some of that was actually not, you know, extrinsic to qualities of the music. That was really like, well, this band doesn't just play at that venue anymore. They play at the other venue where the sellout bands.
Tell you what.
Or they're talking about making a deal with this, and that's an imprint of that, and that's a sellout label. And,
yeah.
You know, so there was a lot of that kind of purity, but really it was, so important to those scenes, you know, that the music you listen to be exactly this kind.
Is this right before you, the, when I was just talking about this on the internet, the Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah, Elegant Bachelors.
That's right. Are they sexy to you?
They are very foxy to me. Yeah.
The Stone Temple Pilots record came out about 6 months after the Pearl Jam record.
Right.
And, or at least the first single did. And the reaction to Stone Temple Pilots kind of across the culture, because grunge was brand new, right? Grunge was sweeping the world. People were losing their mind, young people losing their minds to grunge. And then the Stone Temple Pilots release a record that is in every way just grunge right across home plate. Right, the guitar player and bass player are brothers, the DeLeo brothers. They have really complex chord changes. They have this very dark, deep sound. And then on the top of it is this guy going, yeah. Very what we think of now as grunge.
Okay.
But in that moment, it felt that Scott Weiland, was imitating Eddie Vedder. Because Eddie Vedder was the first kind of main lead rock singer to go, no.
Does the timeline work out? Could they have been imitating Eddie Vedder?
No, not really. I mean, that record, for them to have made that record, they would have been making the record before 10.
Yeah.
And Pearl Jam didn't have a long history.
Right.
They weren't a band for 5 years.
They were Mookie Blaylock
until 6 months before. And I think Stone Temple Pilots actually started in 1989 or something. So It was just a weird coincidence almost that these two lead singers both had a very similar sort of like.
Had never heard a consonant before.
Yeah, the dogs can find her. It could have, you know, the melody, all of it. It could have been Ed Ved in a different universe. And the Stone Temple Pilots record could have come out 2 weeks before the Pearl Jam record. I mean, it was just kind of the fates dictated. And Stone Temple Pilots were just declared posers and wannabes and copycats. And no amount of information to the contrary could convince anybody that this band wasn't just like lame. And it took them, I think, years to overcome the critical kind of like smirk You know, they
Pearl Jam Shadow. It's a big shadow.
And that's a great, that first Stone Temple Pilots record is a great record. All their records were interesting. I mean, I'm not going to say that the lyrics were good, but I don't feel that Paul McCartney's lyrics were very good in the 70s either. So I'm on the, you know, I'm on the shit list of other people.
I think my hottest take is that like one of the greatest musical geniuses of the 20th century is also the worst lyricist. Like never listen to a Stevie Wonder song.
never transcribe it.
Yeah. Sorry. Never listen to the lyrics of just hum along. Cause he is he's an American treasure. He's one of our great geniuses. And the words don't even scan. They don't fit the syllables. They're just doggerel. They're worse than McCartney.
As someone who spends a lot of time working on his lyrics, imagining that every listener is going to be sitting there like with a, you know, with an atlas listening along, like what could
this
be?
Well, that is how a certain kind of very attuned teen listener would like, yeah. I gotta get these messages. It's almost like they have a planchette, you know?
That's right.
You're speaking to them from another dimension. But I have to say, as a music listener myself, I could listen to a song 68 times and somebody will be like, boy, what a brave statement on abuse that song is. And I'm like, what now? The one that goes da 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 da. Abuse? What?
It's the same for me, and I'm that kind
really?
Of lyricist.
What?
But when I listen to songs, I'm like, lo di do di do di do, and it's like, you know, that song's like, you know, about the Iraq War, and I'm like, lo di do di do di do is. I'm the worst.
Like I'm listening to it right now, and I'm like, nope, still nothing. That guy could be saying anything, really. I'm loving this song, and he could be talking about his shoes.
And who cares, really?
Kind of. I mean. I'm not really convinced that lyrics are all that elemental.
Come on,
to most
stop
kinds
it.
Of popular
it's
music.
All I would have put out 40 records by now if I didn't care too much about lyrics.
Think lyrics are harder?
Oh, yeah, for me, way harder. I think lyrics are the hardest part.
That's why you need ChatGPT.
Lyrics just, are the hardest part.
If you've got like 60 demos ready to go, just open AI that baby.
ChatGPT, eh? Hey, ChatGPT, write some lyrics about abuse. Unspecified.
Because if I'm writing some paper about symbolism in the work of George Orwell, you know, you want the facts to be right. But if I just need, I mean, how long is a rock song? If I need 140 words about a sad evening, I bet OpenAI could do that.
I could probably put all the Long Winter's lyrics into ChatGPT. I don't know how ChatGPT works, but if I could say, write in the style of the Long Winter's, like,
the problem is listeners who are not as AI allergic as us are trying this right now.
Oh, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Stop. Move back away from the keyboard.
Because
we don't think it's funny.
The problem is those lyrics will be really sad. You're not ready for what those lyrics are going to teach
too
you.
Too sad.
ChatGPT is like, no, don't make me.
What do you think, just hypothetically, what do you think the odds are you would see those and be like, oh, this is actually not, this could be a song?
The thing is, I don't think you would have to go far. You'd edit them. You'd have to change them, but I don't know how much you would have to change them. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think if I put like refrigerator magnets in a bag and dumped them off of a balcony, I could go down and find the lyrics to a song. Because all the time you write lyrics to a song and you have no idea what you're saying. And then you look at them for 2 weeks and suddenly you realize, oh, I know 100% what I've meant by this all along. And you go and you change a few things around, and then the meaning is crystal clear.
Do you think subconsciously there was a secret about yourself, or do you just think that would be true of any text that you had to keep singing?
This is the big question about art, I think, across the board. Mm-hmm. You know, if like certainly most modernist art or most impressionist art or most abstract art, you're pasting something up and throwing stuff at a canvas, and then at a certain point you're like, it's the birth of the Madonna, or you know, it's a protest art about the Korean War.
You didn't start with a short paragraph of instructions.
No. And I think that's true of anything that is impressionistic and not realistic. But even realistic novels, halfway through the novel, writers are often like, oh, I know what it's about now. It's about Pee-wee loves his bike, and his bike got stolen, and you know, like, what have we been doing?
They can rewrite, you know, a novelist can go back, and I guess a musician can too.
Yeah.
Do you do that once you know what it's about? Does that change the song?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll go back and and rewrite once I know what it's about. Sometimes you don't know what it's about until the record's been out for a year and a half, and somebody comes up and says, boy, thank you for writing that song about my mother-in-law. I'm like, it was about your mother-in-law this whole time.
Do you think, I mean, for them it is, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's another thing about being any kind of, I think, creative producer of stuff. Once it leaves your hands, you know, you put out a book, then it's out of your hands, and then people tell you what the book meant to them, and you don't have any control. You can't say no.
Well, most of my books are so literal that that's not true. Like, yeah. I actually am somebody who starts with a short paragraph of instructions and then writes the book. It's not art, really. It's craft at best. But I admire people that do the other thing.
I think the problem with art is that you can't pick your audience at all. And so you put it out there, and if it's disseminated widely enough, people will find it and appreciate it that you would not have wanted to. You know, there will be people that call you up and they're like, this totally reinforces my worldview. And you're like, no, the opposite. But it's too late. It's too late. It belongs to them now.
All the white supremacists who found your music.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of... you can really read into my lyrics and see that I'm calling for a white homeland.
The secret Christo-fascism of the third Long Winter's record. But, I mean, there are crazies, so you must get... I mean, that will happen whether they contact you or not.
I think that what happens with the Long Winter's music especially is that it gets discovered by romantic people that want to find the recipe for lasting love in the music of the Long Winters. And I can confess that it's not a recipe book for that.
Really, or indeed anything else.
I don't know. Because your marriage has survived 15 years, I don't think you can credit it to any of my songs.
I think you should accept that when people tell you that. Because you don't
thank
know.
You. Thank you. No, I don't. It doesn't belong to me.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, to them, maybe it is the thing that changed how they thought about
love. Sure, they got matching tattoos of the lyrics. And I go, wow.
Have you met any exes that both still have those tattoos after the marriage broke up?
They don't come up and say, you see this? I've been trying to get it off my arm. I'm saving up money to get this taken off my arm. As many of you know, I have a full head of hair, or at least I did until recently. Boy, I can't tell you how much of my, let's just say it, my identity was kind of based in the fact that although I didn't have like Jim Morrison hair, I certainly had a lot of hair for a man my age. And when I started to feel it thin, it wasn't even that it fell out in the bathtub. I could just feel the hair as it went gray got thinner and I didn't know what to do. I went on long walks. I stared out over the ocean. What am I going to do? What am I going to do with thin hair? And of course, you also know, boy, I have a hard time making lists. I certainly have a hard time calling doctors. I was not at all prepared to spend the time and energy trying to digest all of the charlatans and all of the crazy baldness treatments that are out there, the snake oil medicine, etc. And I was thrilled to discover the company Hims, H-I-M-S, Hims. Hims offers convenient access to a full range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including different, like I for one do not like putting all over myself. It makes me feel crazy. And you can get chewy things, oral medication, serums, and sprays, if that's what you prefer. And this is all doctor-trusted, clinically proven stuff, like finasteride and minoxidil, stuff you've heard of, stuff that can stop hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 4 months. None of us should have to go out of our way to feel like ourselves. I mean, none of us should have to stare out at the ocean and think about our thinning hair. Hims brings expert care straight to us with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put our hair first. That's right. And no hidden fees, of course. So for simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, but also for erectile dysfunction, weight loss, and more, Hims is a one-stop shop. Visit hims.com/omnibus. That's hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. Check them out. They do a lot of stuff. A good friend of mine said that he got some medication from Hims that has really been helping him out that's not related to hair loss at all. So I'm intrigued. That's hims.com/omnibus. But remember, individual results may vary. This is based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. So see website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Now, I don't want to just be talking about my own medical problems all the time, my own history of, you know, the many, many pills that I have to take now just to stay alive. But just recently, I went into the doctor and he said that I have prediabetes. And like a lot of Americans, my prediabetes is also comorbid with my high blood pressure and my high bad cholesterol. So here I am in my mid-50s and that is what's going on. So I need to start eating better, exercising, and it's not like I eat terribly, but I need to start really managing all of the, you know, the nutrition that I'm trying to get out of the world. And that's why I'm super grateful to have Factor Meals as part of my program for improving my diet, because Factor Meals has a wide selection of weekly meal options, including seafood options, which, as you know, have good cholesterol and low sugar, choices like salmon and shrimp that aren't more expensive than their other meals. And Factor Meals can help support what I'm now euphemistically describing as my wellness goals. There are even more GLP-1 friendly meals, new Mediterranean diet options packed with protein and good for you fats. So, you know, Mediterranean food is perfect for Americans with diabetes, which I am edging upon. Plus other global flavors like Asian-inspired meals, also not a ton of diabetes there, and bold flavors from China, Thailand, and more. So Factor Meals aren't just meat and potatoes. It's all this marvelous stuff, and plus meat and potatoes. So for more choices of better nutrition, I mean, almost 99% of their customers say that Factor helped them live a healthier life, and it's certainly been true for me. I feel the difference, and my routine has really got to start changing for the better. So here's what you do. You eat smart by going to factormeals.com/omnibus50off and use the code omnibus50off. That's 50 off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. So omnibus 50OFF, not 50OFF, omnibus 50OFF at factormeals.com for 50% off plus free shipping. Get delicious, ready to eat meals delivered with Factor.
Why are we talking about art? I can't remember. Because I like rock and roll.
Right. Why are we talking about art? Well, we think of rock and roll and teenagers being kind of inextricable.
Yes.
And we think of rock and roll sort of developing teenage style, teenagers playing formative roles in new movements in rock.
Sure. Like I can think of some cases.
And really the birth of the idea of a teenager coincides pretty closely with the birth of rock. So
before we called them Bobby Soxers.
Bobby Soxers. But that's the teenager. Yeah, right?
Listening to Sinatra and fainting.
But even that sort of the post-war of it, right? It's we don't think of teenagers exactly starting. There weren't any before 1943.
They just went right into their factory job.
Right. But 1948, you could almost start to see like the nascent teenager kind of coalesce out of the fog.
It's also because they were making trouble. Teenagers, it's a bit of a slur, the T word, you know, like it coincides with the rise of establishment fears about juvenile delinquency and that's what's right. happening to the kids.
That's right. And we, you know, within teenagerism, that idea that teenagers are intrinsically rebellious, that what had formerly been a kind of transition period between childhood, where you were not allowed to wear tall socks, and adulthood, where you were, or in our culture, you know, you cannot.
Had to.
Yeah, you can't put a flute in your nose until you're 14, and then, you know, by the time you're 17, you have a flute in each nostril.
Yeah, that's what you always see teenagers doing. It's,
I guess, more of a Northwest thing.
That's why I don't ride the bus anymore. I'm like, I keep getting hit in the head by the flutes of the teen behind me.
Flute noise.
If you're going to have a flute in each nostril, don't turn your head so fast.
but there was kind of an origin point for all these connections kind of coalesced in that post-war moment. That spawned, you know, a thousand nostril flutes, a thousand, you know,
fads, and
a thousand ships, and all these things that we think of as just waves and waves and waves of culture that are living memory. I mean, my mom was what, 16 in 1950. So as a 16-year-old in 1950...
That's why she hated Elvis. She had already imprinted on his predecessor.
Yeah, on Vaughn Monroe. As a 16-year-old in 1950, my mom did not identify with teenagers when teenagers... Because...
She was like you.
A little...
We never would have done this.
Right.
We were serious people when we were in school.
By 1954, she was 20 and she was an adult and listened to adult things and did adult things and wore adult clothes and she was trying to be a member of the adult world. And in 1954, there was suddenly a new demographic that in her experience as in 1950, she was wearing poodle skirts or whatever, but there was no clear, like, nothing was made for teenagers. Nothing was suggested as being for teenagers. You were just in a holding pattern. You weren't quite married yet, in other words.
You were not a consumer. You were not marketed to. I love the idea of your mom basically being Brian Cox in Succession and looking at all these people and say, you know, you are not serious people. As she surveys the youth landscape of the early 50s.
You are not serious people. You are not. You can't be serious people.
But your mom's like, you know, she's done the marketing. She's got, she has a job. She's paid all her bills. She's, you know, double noted all the amounts in both parts of the checkbook and it's all balanced. And she looks at these kids screaming at Elvis. Come on.
Come on, kids. When you think about you and I both have teenage children.
Yeah, just barely. You're on your way in, I'm on my way out.
That's right.
Enjoy that, by the way.
You've got a couple of hours left, right? Till you have no more teenagers?
My teenager is still, they're an age that ends with teen, but they are legally an adult.
Right.
I couldn't make them put the flutes in their nose or take it out.
Or
the piercing, as it were.
But if you think about about child labor laws.
As I often do when I see my kids. As I see my struggling children.
In the United States, the minimum age for non-agricultural work is still 14. There are restrictions on hours and types of work for those under 16, and you can't do hazardous work until you're 18. But my daughter at 14 could now get and keep a job.
My youngest had a hard time finding, in practice, a teen job in Seattle.
Yeah.
Perhaps because of local laws and liability issues. A lot of places that legally could, under federal law, hire a 15-year-old to stock shelves will not do so.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a lot harder, and that may not be true if the current administration eliminates all foreign-born labor.
The children do yearn for the mines. Yeah. So it might be a lot easier.
But my kid at 14 years old is absolutely would not be a good employee.
Oh, no.
Not because she's not a marvelous person, but because she has never I mean, and I'm one of these dads that makes her learn to use tools, but she doesn't have.
But you're not a great employee.
Or employer.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if you're who I would look to if I was like, how should I be at the office? Let me look at John. Yeah. Roderick.
Well, how would John handle this situation with his boss? And so this summer I've been trying to give, I've opened her a checking account. I'm trying to give her some jobs. She's doing some landscaping, which was one of my first jobs.
I see, non-agricultural.
That's right. But in the wartime era, and immediately afterwards, it was still very common for kids at age 14 to leave school and begin their work life, particularly young women. Hmm. There was a lot of work in factories. I mean, we think
during
of,
the war, right?
During the war. Yeah. But then also after the war, if you were poor, you get farmed out to domestic work or office work.
Plus, once the barriers go away, like, no, this is a place where women were and did fine. I mean, a lot of those jobs stayed mixed.
Yeah, right. Well, right. And it was kind of the first example of like, well, no man wants to do this. Maybe right. We'll, you know, these girls have small hands.
Let the gals try it.
Yeah. So our story kind of begins in this, this immediate après-war time, until the late 40s in the UK, rationing continued to be a big part of the culture. I was at a car show the other day, and there was a Cadillac there. And as we walked up, I was with my mom, and she said, "That's a pre-war Cadillac." And I said, "I don't know. I don't know a woman who lived through the war."
let me car-splain.
"I feel like it's a 46. And she said, "That's a 41 Cadillac."
Wow.
And I said, "A 41? And so we walk over, and sure enough, on the windshield, there's a ration sticker. And she pointed at the sticker and was all tattered. She pointed at the sticker and she said, "That's an A ration sticker." That meant they got more gasoline in rationing than anybody else.
It's a U.S. rationing thing, right?
Yeah. And I said, "I wonder what the person did to get an A sticker on their Cadillac." I saw an A ration sticker on a Cadillac. The voice inside my head, "Don't look me."
See, that's what rock and roll is. Mm-hmm. Songs about Cadillacs, because it rhymes.
And she said, "Well, my grandfather had an A ration sticker, but it was because he was a postman." And then the man that owned the car came over and he said, "It is a 41. And the ration.
Was he also from 41? It is a 41.
It is a 41. No, he's quite a bit younger. He was a boomer.
Millionaire.
But he said the ration sticker was actually something he found on the internet.
Oh.
And he put it on there because he's cosplaying.
But still.
Yeah. But
what a weird thing to cosplay as. Like, I'm just so nostalgic for America emerging from World War II.
But in the UK, there was a lot less stuff available than there was in the United States.
The war did a number on the UK, and it went forever. Like, it went to the 50s. People don't realize.
Yeah, the World War II just kept going.
Like, they just didn't have coffee until, like, 1975.
And so there was rationing on fabric until the late 40s. And that meant that there kind of wasn't any new style. There wasn't any British fashion industry. And when we think about, if you put the word British and fashion together in some contexts, you're going to go, ho, ho, ho. But really the, you know, English and British style has, I mean, it's been dictating style. To people in the West. Yeah. For centuries. Right?
But it's true. There is that gap, you know, that pre-Carnaby, pre-Twiggy gap where you're like, British style.
British style.
And it's because of this post-war austerity, for sure.
A lot of austerity, and then, of course, people had no money to pay for fashion. A lot of people were still, most 14-year-old girls in 1948 would know how to sew, just as that was probably true here in the United States. I mean, knowing how to sew was a basic home economic skill.
And even as an adult now, I still have some envy for it because I'm like, too, boy, God. I should be darning socks. Why am I throwing this sock away?
I have a box of things that need to be mended, and mending is a skill that I possess.
Yeah, I too have a year of home ec. I should be able to do this. I could put a button on.
Yeah, but the amount of mending that I want to do is a lot less than the amount of mending I have to do. And yeah, I wish I'd taken a second year of home ec just to get the feel of that thimble under my fingers, and like, this is just something that I do when I'm sitting around.
Right. You know the stitches, but it never became part of your life.
That's exactly it. I can't knit either.
It's not too late.
I can finger knit. You know, I put sweaters back together all the time. But
oh,
I,
really?
But I can't.
If I have a hole in a sweater, should I bring it to you and see
what
you
can do? Yeah, I could monkey around with it. But it's like, oh, maybe part of the problem is I don't watch TV. And so.
That's what it is.
I don't have a thing to sit and do while I'm.
Your mid-century mom is listening to the radio or watching TV. That's and right. They've got a basket of mending.
That's all right. A basket of mending. A basket of
mending. Well, I don't have. I watch a ton of streaming shows. I should have a basket of mending.
There you go.
And I just put on Daredevil Born Again, and off we go, darning socks.
Maybe I should bring my mending to you.
There we go. I could darn your socks during Daredevil Born Again.
Well, right at the end of rationing, Savile Row, which had been clearly like flatlining throughout the war, nobody was buying any new top coats during the war.
We needed those top coats to fight Hitler.
And I think most of the Savile Row shops actually were making officers' uniforms throughout the war. And they were probably really sick of using khaki and dark green fabric. And there was there was a labor government, right? They'd gotten rid of Churchill. And there was a sort of a feeling burbling up among the upper classes that labor austerity was something that the upper class was kind of mocking and was ready to push back on. Like, oh, your labor austerity is just keeping us down, and it's time for a new era of flashy, rich people.
Bring back the bright young things of the 20s.
So in 1949, there was an attempt by the first new style that Savile Row was kind of going to promulgate to men was a return to Edwardian fancy.
Ooh, of all things.
Of all things. So the Edwardian era is the very beginning of the 20th century, 1900s. And it was a time it was sort of modern dress in a way, blazers and, I mean, women were still kind of in pretty elaborate.
There's big skirts still.
Skirts, but it would be recognizable to us, morning coats and drapey coats, a kind of style that we see come and go, where the waists are narrow and the shoulders are broad. Velvet collars, you know, you can.
Does it look kind of foppish though? Like, would we look at that and be like, "Oh, you're a lot." Like, congrats on your. Brian Jonestown Massacre cover band.
Yeah, you would. I mean, right now, what we think of as kind of drapey jackets, they're making a comeback because there's, we've been living through a period of men's fashion where it's very narrow pants, very narrow lapels, very tight fitting jackets, really clothes that you would look at any other time in men's fashion and go, you know, your suit doesn't fit. It's for a smaller man. But that's been the style now for a long time, right? High water, really, really narrow cut things.
Slim fit everything. It's like the default that these whole retailers that'll just mostly sell you, you know, if you go to Zara or Uniqlo, that's what they have.
Right. And there was that James Bond movie where he showed up in a tuxedo and you could see his shirt under the button, you know, like he had it buttoned and there was like this big white bunch of shirt between that and his pants, and it was like, maybe this is James Bond.
James Bond should not be overeating.
No, James Bond is not wearing a J. Crew suit. Like, stop it. This has gone too far. So now there's a return to this much drapier, broader lapels, narrow waist, big shoulders. You're going to see it in the next just couple of years. Like high-waisted
zoot suits are back.
Zoot suity kind of pleated pants, wider legs, and it does feel like. If you look at those thin suits as an example of austerity, if you thought of them that way, like
less fabric.
We don't have any fabric, things need to be cheap, they need to be small. And now these new suits expressing an era of luxury and abundance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that isn't actually true.
It doesn't reflect actual markets.
Yeah, the style is disconnected from reality, but it does the opulence of more fabric is something that is real, right?
Yeah.
And I think maybe it's because millennials are aging and they're like, I don't look good in this, these skinny clothes. And they're looking back and going, I never looked good in these. Nobody does. Nobody looks. I mean, if you're a man over the age of 18 and you have pants that go down to your ankle in a peg, then they have to go up to your butt somehow. And if your butt is
there, will be a cone.
There's going to be, you're definitely going to look like an inverted triangle at some point. So out comes this collection of sort of Savile Row. It's the first new bunch of men's style after the war in 49. And it's Edwardian influenced, kind of opulent, sort of throwback style that's trying to kind of cash in on this conservative riposte to labor austerity, and it just futzes. Nobody adopts it.
Nobody actually wants it.
Yeah, the people don't. It's one of the instances where the fashion industry tries something and it's a bubble and nobody actually buys into it. And maybe it's because still most people didn't have money.
Yeah.
They didn't have the money to spend on clothes in this way. And so.
And you're not going to take a risk.
You're not going to be the one.
If you
can
afford, if this is your first suit in 5 years.
Yeah.
Hey, these might come back.
But what was interesting was there was, by this point in time, there had become a what we now love, what I love. It was the dawn of the charity shop, the thrift store, where people
Oxfam.
Yeah, where people were emptying their closets, and if you were poor, you could go get serviceable garments for cheap. And during this whole period where everybody was wearing their clothes until they were patched and threadbare, there was no kind of like, this is in style, this is out of style exactly. During the whole war period, it was like, does it work? Is it solid? And there was a generation of young people who, coming out of the war, all of the many conversations we've had about where teenagers came from, why teenagers became their own demographic, this was really the very beginning of that. The kids that had been born like just before the war, that had grown up in the war, had grown up in the rubbles of London, were now looking for ways to make this transition to adulthood. A lot of them were already working. They were working class kids or kids that had been working from their teen years on and kind of unsupervised and beginning to, and influenced by jazz and very neighborhood oriented. And they started to adopt these Edwardian styles, partly influenced by this attempt of Savile Row to say, like, here's the new look. But these kids could find those jackets and those pants and those waistcoats in the thrift shops that were actually the original Edwardian clothes.
So they were not buying the unsold stuff from 1950. They were buying their maybe grandparents' clothes.
So initially they echoed, there were kids kind of scattered throughout London that were like, oh, that's the style. Look at this. I found this. Yeah, this was my grandfather's coat, or not even, right? The Edwardian fashion ended at the First World War.
Yeah, that's true.
And that would have only
could have been their parents.
Yeah, it would have been 30 years old.
In their parents' closet or attic.
But then Savile Row had manufactured this stuff and didn't sell. They dumped it on the secondary market, on the clothing stores that sold stuff for discount price.
Oxfam shops are now full of nothing but this.
And so then more kids could, that didn't have the you know, that didn't have that stuff in their grandfather's closet, but also couldn't afford new clothes, were able to take this stuff and process it sort of into a new youth subculture that did echo Zoot Suits. There were a lot of similarities between these kind of drapey costumes.
There's color, they're, yeah.
And the kind of the opulence implied by velvet, the opulence implied by big. And this was being noted as a subculture in boys, right? It was predominantly seen like early on as a kind of gang. That was the only context, in the same way that Zoot Suiters were, although
it seemed menacing that all the kids were now dressing like,
yeah, because like they were blue collar.
Yeah.
And so
it's funny though, it's the last kind of clothing that we think of as street gang coded, as, you know, Edwardian cuffs.
Right. Yeah. And during the war, there was a kind of a subculture of criminal called spivs. They were people that they kind of ran the black market, and they dressed, they dressed sort of fancy, but they were on the street kind of selling black market goods. And although they were gangsters or criminals, people kind of loved them because they were in a lot of ways the only way you could get the only way you could get a lot of things was on the black market.
Like, and not just nice things, like, you know, yeah. For a while, that's where you could get sugar probably.
Right. And so there were associations with kind of gangster culture already, kind of dressing fancy beyond your lower middle class station. But very quickly, they kind of started to be singled out as dangerous. And I think it really is in that juxtaposition. Like, as soon as these kids started adopting that Edwardian dress, that was still prep school clothing, right? I mean, if you went to public school in the UK, and by public, I mean private, as we often mistake, your morning dress was in this style, the drapey coat that you wore as part of upper class education. It had its origins, and one of the things that made it distinctive, one of the things that made prep school kids sort of stand out, was their anachronistic clothing.
And it's transgressive now for these have not kids to be wearing essentially the same thing.
And it ruined it for the private school kids.
For the posh kids.
What the hell? Why are they, you know, clothing signified so much more then than it, or signaled so much more then than it does now in terms of just the rigid class distinctions. Right. And so here were these young people wearing these clothes that they weren't entitled to. They hadn't earned, or it wasn't, you know, their family didn't deserve it. So the panic about it started pretty early. They were originally called, in 1953, a movie came out called Kosh Boy, and a kosh was slang for a blackjack.
Yeah, a kosh.
But the kosh boy in the film was dressed in this sort of style.
And is he mugging people? Is he knocking people out with a kosh and taking their pocketbooks?
Yeah, he's a bad boy.
He's doing street crimes.
He's doing street crimes. And there wasn't initially, it wasn't a scene that coalesced around music, but music pretty quickly became part of the scene.
What were the kids listening to?
Well, they had the original kind of theme song of this scene was a tune by Ken McIntosh called The Creep. And if you listen to it, this is 1954, it is just like heavy on the saxophones, and it's kind of like bump, bom, 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 bom. You know, like
stripper music?
Oh, no, not quite.
Does it seem big bandy still to us?
Nope. It's a smaller combo. It seems like proto rock, but there's no real, it's not a guitar song.
Yeah.
And it's got a kind of like, yeah, like, it feels sort of urban and it feels kind of,
it would put off an adult in the early 50s.
Yeah. The honking saxophone is the precursor to the guitar.
Right.
And the creep was the tempo was just sort of slow enough that you could dance to it in sort of a, it wasn't Bobby Soxer, you know.
Is the creep the dance you do to it? Do the creep.
Well, the creep ended up being, it ended up being where the name for the suede shoes that became a big part of this scene. They're called creepers.
Oh, I didn't know.
And that was taken from the fact that the creep was like the theme song of this group. And eventually the term teddy boy was coined because this is the
Ted from Edwardian?
Ted from Edwardian.
Hmm.
Like the classic way that the British press likes to nickname everything as a, you know, it's all Cockney slang.
I've never liked Ted as a nickname for Edward. I had a friend, my friend Ted is an Edward, and like Ted Kennedy style. And we always thought that was a little suspect. Where are you pulling the tea from?
Do you say that to him? Or are you like, sorry?
Yeah, I hope he doesn't listen.
I'm not calling you that.
We called him Tedward for years because we thought it was kind of stolen valor to just make that T appear. Yeah, if you're an Edward, you can be Ed.
You can be Ed.
But you can't choose to be Ted.
But not Ted. Change of seasons issues that I face is that, you know, every twice a year I change the sheets on my bed. No, no, no. I change the sheets on my bed all the time. And in fact, I read something the other day that that ladies feel like when they show up at somebody's house, if the person has dark sheets, that's a bad sign. You don't want to have dark sheets on your bed because it seems to be a thing that you do. You choose if you're trying to conceal a multitude of sins, but not me. I have only fresh white sheets, and on my bed at this very moment are my Miracle Made sheets that I've had now for a long time. They appear not to wear. They're still in as good a condition as they were when I got them. Unlike, say, for instance, my flannel sheets, which are falling apart at the seams. But what's marvelous about Miracle Made sheets, there are several things. And I know that you've all heard what's so marvelous about Miracle Made sheets before, but I'm going to tell you again, Miracle Made sheets are temperature regulating so that in the fall here in Seattle, in the autumn, sometimes it's 40 degrees, sometimes it's 75 degrees. It's impossible to know whether you should sleep with the windows open or not, but your Miracle Made sheets are always going to keep you exactly the right of cool and crisp while you sleep. And they're infused, as you know, you could probably say it with me. They're in silver infused fabrics that were inspired by NASA. And that's part of how they regulate your temperature with this silver infused fabric. Now, I'm not a chemist or a silver infuser, so I can't, you know, describe exactly what's happening, but it certainly from personal experience has worked for me. And plus, the other marvelous thing about them is that bed sheets, you know, they get dust mites, they get bacteria, they, you know, you're sleeping in there, you're breathing on them. And Miracle Made Sheets' silver component is a natural antibacterial. So for those reasons alone, the temperature regulating and the self-cleaning, I mean, that is reason enough to prefer these sheets over others. But the quality of them, the comfort, the smoothness of the thread count, like they're just great sheets. I can't recommend them highly enough. So upgrade your sleep as the weather changes. Go to trymiracle.com/omnibus. That's trymiracle.com/omnibus to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40% off of the normal price. And if you use our promo code Omnibus at checkout, you'll get a free 3-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a free refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/omnibus and use the code omnibus to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/omnibus to treat yourself. Thanks, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
So teddy boys are Edwardian boys.
Edwardian boys. And they're springing up in all the places that now you love in London, Notting Hill and Portobello Road. All the shops on Portobello Road are selling these crazy jackets, as they probably are even now. All the
what were then kind of cheap bohemian neighborhoods in West London.
Yeah, and all the East London or East End sort of places where the buildings were still in rubble from the Blitz. From the bombs. And it start and so many things are developing at this time that we now think of as being rock and roll. The duck's ass or quiff haircut that was kind of very independently cooked up, just a like a haircut. I've never actually worn one. My mom never has called them anything but duck's ass.
Duck's ass.
And I'm like, there's a lot of other names for it. The quiff. The pompadour.
It's a pompadour.
And she's like, duck's ass.
That must be kind of a, is that a rural American way to see it? I see fewer duck's asses than perhaps than a farm girl would.
I think maybe DA is something it was also called, the DA.
Because you can't say.
Because you can't say duck's ass around your mom.
In polite society.
But if your mom says it.
And so that does not have Edwardian roots, but that would go with like somebody be wearing these vintage clothes and they'd have one of these really super styled haircuts.
Well, and a lot of stuff started to come in, and they were drawing from a lot of elements, right? The high waisted pleated pants, but the waistcoats, like that all came from Edwardian stuff. But the suede creeper shoes, bolo ties, like they were finding elements in the shops of Portobello Road and combining them into what was clearly meant to be over the top fancy, something beyond just, they weren't aping.
Yeah. It's a rebuke. Earlier style. It's a rebuke. It's a rebuke to the current fashion standards.
And in the United States, there was a similar sort of teen menace, but it was much more connected to leather and yes. denim it's and like t-shirts. It's
a motorcycle coated look, right?
Yeah. And these scary denim kids were coming to your town and they were going to get your teenagers all hooked on cigarettes.
It's more of it's explicitly kind of casual wear. It's working class. It's the opposite of the vintage shop look.
But because of in that moment, there was now America was sort of newly a real content creator. American cinema, in the UK, they were consuming American culture.
Their ideas of youth rebellion are our iconography.
Right. And so the premiere of the film Blackboard Jungle in the UK introduced a lot of ideas of teenagerism and rock and roll in particular.
Yeah, Rock Around the Clock is in Blackboard Jungle.
Yeah, it's
which is such a stodgy, it's like a stodgy Glenn Ford classroom movie if you watch it today, but at the time
it was wild. It had
Bill Haley and the Comets in it, so.
And it had Sidney Poitier, like it was transgressive at a lot of different levels. And it was really then, 55, that what had been this working class teddy boy culture adopted rock and roll as its soundtrack. And when we think of teddies, particularly in the rock scene or in a fashion sense, you think of them as inextricably connected to really rockabilly and early rock. It's a big part of they seem to be like mated from their inception. But in fact, by that point, teddy boy culture was 6 years old and had
they'd existed with nothing but jazz.
With jazz. And they suddenly found themselves mated with rock and roll. At premieres of Blackboard Jungle across the UK, there were riots as the kids watching the film were revolutionized.
This is it.
This is it. Like It's today. We're tearing up the seats. We're burning down the theater. And this was at a time when the profile of young women as teens, even as part of this rebellious, if you think about Rebel Without a Cause, I mean, these are a lot of, if you think about most of the American rebel rock and roll movies, like there are fast girls, but the girls aren't,
they're not the rebels.
They're not the rebels. Right. They're often,
they're the long suffering girlfriends or
the ones that get stolen away from their virginal youths.
I mean, they don't have a lot of agency because that's not, it wasn't really feminist art back then, the youth movie.
But what was crazy in women's fashion is that prior to the war, in the immediate aftermath of the Edwardian era, the flappers were the first, that was the sort of the first women's fashion to respond to Edwardian frippery with androgyny. It was a very political statement of the time in the Roaring Twenties. Women wearing short hair, sack clothes, you know, in some cases tight clothes, but deconstructed clothes.
Yeah, not a figure enhancing kind of a thing.
Right. And those styles had sort of introduced this rebellious, anti-authoritarian women's fashion that kind of percolated underground. I mean, during the Depression, everybody was just sort of wearing whatever potato sack they could cut armholes in. But in the after-war period, there was the new style. There was a return to kind of expensive fashion for women, big hats and big shoulder pads. It was more masculine, even high fashion, but a return to femininity and a return to luxe. But the seeds had been planted that girls could dress like boys, and it was a not just a nonconformity, but as artistically.
Yeah, it's a marker of style.
It's a marker of style and a marker of independence, even from the boys that you're aping or influenced by. Yeah. Well, what history would have normally done is forgotten the Teddy Girls, because the Teddy Girls never in their time achieved enough notoriety, enough visibility to be considered sort of anything but the girlfriends, I guess, of the Teddy Boys who were making the scene and ended up being the Teddy Boys became were the forefathers of both the rockers and the mods. They were the forerunners of what became Teddy Boy culture then reciprocated rockabilly culture, so that by the 60s, American rockabillies were dressing like British Teddy Boys or with a lot of those influences.
And through the American lens, all British youth culture of this period culminates in the Beatles, and, you know, they emerged from Teddy Boys, right?
They really did. They all had those quiffs at first.
Yeah.
And the Beatles velvet suit collars.
And McCartney wrote a song about Teddy Boys, I think. So you think of that. So, like, that's how I think an American, especially a younger American, comes across this culture is like, it's a Beatles precursor, like skiffle.
Well, but by the time of punk rock in the 70s, Teddy Boy had then gone through a couple of iterations. And in the 80s and even in the 90s in Seattle, there were plenty of people dressing in Edwardian jackets with leopard print creepers. And
so it never fully assimilated? Like, those people would see themselves as Teddy Boy descended?
Well, it's funny, in all of the sort of gang wars of the 60s and 70s rock fans, like mods who were descendants of Teddy Boys, mm-hmm. and skinheads who were sort of descendants of mods, mods being more interested in soul music, skinheads being then influenced by ska and reggae, they teamed up against rockers who were descendants of Teddy Boys in the...
it's really like Abraham's
it is.
Children fighting.
But then the Teds sided with the rockers, and the mods and skinheads thought of the Teds and rockers as being like old, like nostalgia heads. And but then by the time it was the 1970s, like who was...
Yeah, punk is the era of which.
Yeah, and punk is, exactly, like punk is descended then from both mods
right.
and Teds, but culminating, you know, recombining.
Very, we need a graph.
Very it's confusing. Very confusing. But when you think about the girls that are part of Ted culture, the girls that are part of rock culture, the girls that are part of mod and skin culture, they're always kind of... positioned as just the girlfriends.
Do right? they dress like their respective male fashion icons or?
What's interesting is that each one of those subgroups that has the women in those groups dress in very distinctive and very influential styles that are only 40% related to or connected to what the boys in that subculture are wearing.
What's the other 60? Is it like what women are wearing in at the time, mainstream women are wearing, or like what else are they doing?
So as American and as American sort of rocker and British Teddy culture started cross-pollinating with one another, the girls were wearing not Edwardian women's clothes, but they were also repurposing Edwardian men's clothes in a style that was really novel. And they did kind of adopt pencil skirts and like hobble skirts, what you would think of as like sort of flapper era clothes, but they were repurposing the rolled up jeans of American teeny boppers. They were wearing flat shoes, straw boaters.
Really? That I don't think I've seen.
Toreador pants.
I was with you till you got to the straw boaters.
This is also a time when the ponytail itself would have been a rebellious.
Professional women don't wear a.
Yeah, like.
Moms and wives don't wear ponytails, right?
And you see it then in the fashion of like the girls that were part of the rocker scene were much more leopard print, much more like dark poodle skirt, you know. But skinhead girls had their own kind of androgyny that was they're called skinbirds.
Skinbirds.
And their vibe is so different from skinheads in some ways, fashion-wise. I mean, they're crazy.
Birds have different plumage, the men and the women. It's not just a reflection of the male or the female.
And weirdly, it's birds with a Y.
Oh, it's not like Skinbirds. It's not like me bird?
No, it's bird. It's the other bird. It's Admiral Bird, they're named after.
Very few bands are less skinhead-coded than the Birds. Right? Like what's the least ska band of the 60s?
Yeah, maybe the Birds. But a lot of this, a lot of these subcultures, they don't, because they don't ascend to mainstream, right? If you think about what is in mainstream culture for fashion in the early 60s, the late 50s.
Yeah, a lot of the youth culture bubbles up, right?
It bubbles up. We get Twiggy. We get, we get kind of the short hair, the androgyny, but it's...
And, you know, high fashion models in Milan and New York are wearing, like, Carnaby-looking stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Mod-descended fashion.
But it feels like it's coming from the top down, because there isn't any reportage. There's no, none of these kids ever becomes a star in their own right, right? No one can, until the Beatles, no one can say like, oh, here's some working class kids that changed the world. But in 2005, in the archives of Picture Post magazine, which was kind of the life magazine in the UK, really focused on photojournalism.
Yeah.
In the archives, there were discovered 50-plus photographs taken in 1955 of Teddy girls in the in their native environments, kind of in the East End, standing in the rubble of bombed-out buildings. All of these girls, 13 through 16.
It's under the radar enough that I never even, I did not know the phrase Teddy girls. Like, yeah. I would be like, yeah, I can tell you what a teddy boy is. Teddy girl?
And these, this photo essay was, they were photos taken by a young Ken Russell.
Oh, wow. Future film director Ken Russell.
Future director of the movie Tommy and of Altered States.
A lot of crazy movie. A lot of, yeah.
Right.
Did we do a show Women about, did we do a show about, yeah, the Lauren stuff, but didn't we do a show about Listomania or something? Or didn't we do some show that was some, that was Ken Russell adjacent? Did we not do Listomania on Omnibus?
We did Listomania.
Oh, okay. Ken Russell joined.
Ken Russell. Here he is again. Another Ken Russell in the Omnibus. But Ken Russell had, as a young man, he was 25, had was kind of living in Notting Hill or whatever, and saw these girls out as part of the street culture, and went out and took a bunch of photos of them just of a day. And when those photos were rediscovered in 2005, everyone recognized that at, in 1955, all of the seeds of punk rock, of mod culture, of skinhead culture, of
you've got 20, 30 years of the future right in those photos.
Yeah. Annie Hall, like it's all there in this group of teen girls coming out of this period of great austerity. You can see that they all are not just working class girls, but girls that are getting off work. Yeah. 14-year-olds, you know, my daughter doesn't even know how to, we were working in the yard yesterday and I was like, go back and disconnect the hose from the house. And she goes over to the hose and she's like, how am I supposed to? And I said, if you can't undo a hose from the house, your Montessori education was wasted. I just poured that money down the drain.
You're going to be hose dad.
I'm going to be hose dad.
You better watch out.
But, you know, these girls had obviously just come from the factory. And they had all of this stuff. The collars turned up with the brooch, you know, the kind of cameo brooch at the neck, the men's jacket, the high-waisted pants with the cuffs, the, I mean, everything about it, their hair. They looked so contemporary in 2005, as they do now. And
what does that mean? Fashion hasn't paused, but
what's,
if you look good enough in 55, you also look fashionable in 75 and 95.
I think that there's been a lot of kind of people in fashion and people in culture trying to look at these photos and make and find any evidence that this, that it's on a continuum, that this small group of girls with this incredible sort of homemade fashion would have been the people seeding subsequent generations of kids. And there's no way there. You Vivian know. Westwood wasn't one of these girls. There's no sign that anybody knew that these photographs existed or that these girls continued in as part of a subculture that then influenced subsequent subcultures. And yet it's all there.
Did any of them emerge? I mean, some of them could have been alive, right?
No, yeah, absolutely.
No follow-up reporting that you know of trying to track them down?
So, yeah, a lot of the girls were kind of contacted by writers, but you know, none of them had gone on to become fashion icons. They all recalled their times as Teddy girls. Mary Tuvey gave a long interview where she described sort of how she came to her clothes.
But none of them stayed fashion connected.
No, they were poor girls from the wrong part of London. They also called themselves the Judies. But they Teddy's ended the up, Judies. You know, it's kind of like all the, when you do those Beatles documentaries and you reach out to the, you know, the 25 young women that were the
throwing absolute, jelly babies.
Yeah. The most connected to the Beatles. They all were part of, you know, their friend group, and you know, they all live in some house in Merseyside, and you know, none of them became internet superstars, international superstars,
rather. Or internet superstars,
right?
Either way,
although at any time one of them might be an internet superstar. All they have to do is,
it's not too late,
try and teach their kid to use a hose.
And that concludes Teddy Girls, entry 1283.PR3122, certificate number 13953, in the omnibus. Omnibus is officially anti-social media. We're anti-social,
mm-hmm.
And we are media, and we are anti-social media.
We are media, and we are you and I both. Oh, God. Can you imagine what we would be like in a normal world, in a different timeline?
What do you mean?
I mean a timeline where none of this...
Like, are we have office jobs or something?
Yeah, right. If you had stayed a computer programmer and I had what? What would I have ever been? I guess I would have taught at a community college. I'd be like Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
Some community college where my roommate came by and was like, you're just mad I won the Fields Medal.
You could be HR somewhere. I don't know.
HR?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
You'd have to knuckle down and knuckle under.
I can't do either thing.
People come by your desk and ask if you saw the game.
Oh, God. Hey,
you like to chat?
You having trouble with those TPS reports?
You like to chat? Oh, you wouldn't mind. Maybe you'd be the one coming by people's desks and being like, brr, 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 brr. So I made some chili last weekend. I'm going to be eating that all week. Or, I don't know. Whatever.
And you're sitting there trying to...
Yeah, that's great.
Hey, John, look... I've got a deadline. In fact, don't you have a deadline?
Well, that's a pretty good idea for a podcast. Like, one co-host is trying to like finish like some 80 lines of code or something. Like, they need to get this thing out the door. And the other guy is just like, hey, so are you watching Andor?
That is a pretty good idea for a podcast. I wonder why nobody's doing that.
It would be the opposite of chemistry. You know, like a lot of podcasting is pretending you want to listen to the other person, at least in my experience. this would be the opposite vibe.
And we're just like, yeah, great. Well, thanks for stopping by.
Get away from my desk. That's the name of the show. And that's why we're not on social media, even though I was just showing John a clip on Blue Sky. We were at Omnibus Project for a while. But there's still places to hang out if you're an Omnibus fan. There's Futurelings on Facebook, mm-hmm. There's a Discord. There's a subreddit.
Ken is going to get Ken's-Jennings.com back up and
maybe
running.
Maybe someday I'll get the blog back so it won't crash, so WordPress won't crash when you try to look at it. You can go to alt.fan.omnibus and see what's going on there on the news groups.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, there should be a news group. Somebody, is it too late to start a new Usenet news group?
Are there still news groups?
I mean, I think so.
Huh.
I think there's some Google portal. Maybe they don't support it anymore.
This might be another one of those generational things where I have no idea what a use group is, and you know everything about what a use group is.
No, we've talked about news groups.
I know.
But yeah, go to alt.fan.johniscconfused.
.org.
It's not .ru. And you can send us email to theomnibusproject@gmail.com. That was always an option in our era. That's where the addenda shows come from.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody writes, there's no addenda. Addenda would just be you and me talking about that elephant.
Well, I think we can do minutes. That for now.
Special all Esowit.
Ken, how's Esowit today? Ken. Well, John?
That reminds me, we have to do an addenda show in just a minute. Like, not for our...
Oh, well, don't give away any of that Esowit content.
Was that splatter splot thing going to be on the show, whatever that was? Like, did everyone hear that or splatter, just me? What was that?
We'll never know.
Well, if you just heard that splatter splat thing, that was supposed to be there. That was an artistic choice. It's part of John using AI to write his lyrics now. And so I guess I should be looking up Esowen and seeing what he's up to. Addenda listeners, Patreon donors know that there's a baby elephant sponsored by the Omnibus Project who makes appearances on the Addenda. If you don't know about this, it means you're not a Patreon supporter. You've been enjoying just a fraction of the Omnibus experience. And if you go to patreon.com/omnibusproject, you'll read about other avenues of enjoyment that are available to you. Addenda shows, early access to the week's show. Many more perks. Is that how you say perks?
Perks. No, I don't say it's it like any a bird weird call. Way. Perks. I just say perks like the normal way.
Not me. I just say, like, even in a sentence, I'll be like, yeah, what are some of the perks of your job? And blah, 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 Facebook, Patreon, is that kind of it? You can send us physical items. I didn't get the mail today, so I don't have any, but you could send physical items to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Send John all your big-shouldered velvet jackets.
Please. Although I'm a 46 long, I don't think...
There weren't that many of those.
There weren't many of those.
In Edwardian times.
No, they were small. Although there are a lot of them now because the punk rock, rockabilly subculture is full of big dudes.
Large men like rockabilly.
Large.
What do you think that is? What introduces the large teen to rockabilly pipeline? Where does it come from?
That's a really good question.
Are you impressive on the dance floor if you're a large young person?
There are a lot of rock subcultures where you think of everybody being pretty skinny.
Yes.
Rockabilly, you don't think of it as being especially skinny subculture.
All sizes can enjoy rockabilly.
Yeah, I don't know why that would be. I don't know why, like, big guys choose some
big lurpy
things.
Guys.
Lurpy, derpy guys.
Love rockabilly. That's what we learned. Lurpy guys love rockabilly. That's where I got my rap name, LL Rock J. That's not right.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word.
You're off book. You can do that without reading the thing.
Yeah, look at me. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.